your groceries. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross this morning. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why you can now grow a vegetable garden in your front yard in Florida. Call us and join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, fighting allergy season this summer. All of that and more is ahead. And first this hour, it is now legal in Florida to grow a vegetable garden in your front yard. This new law is seen as a victory for urban gardeners and food activists working to fight hunger and food insecurity. This bill, Senate Bill 82, was signed into law last week and sponsored by Senator Rob Bradley of Fleming Island. It went into effect last week, actually, and it renders void and unenforceable local jurisdiction over front yard gardens. That means local governments cannot tell you where to grow a garden on your own property. Nathan Ballantyne, a.k.a. the man in overalls, is a Jacksonville itinerant urban farmer, entrepreneur, educator, and community organizer. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
And Michael Neff is also here. He's with Feeding Northeast Florida. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jessica.
We're now going to take a closer look with both of these guys and have some tips on how to grow your own front yard vegetable garden. So what questions do you have about growing your groceries in any part of your yard now? Call us now, 549-2937. So Nathan, why is this law a victory and an important one for you in your work?
Yeah, this law is a big victory for Victory Gardens, as it were. I deal with a lot of folks that are starting gardens, and there's a lot of nervousness around, oh, well, can I actually have a garden in my front yard? Is there a law against that? And so this simplifies things, and the answer is no. So go for it.
Yeah. I could understand there being a lot of nervousness about starting a garden in general, right? Mm-hmm. I would be very nervous to try to grow anything. I've never grown anything successfully. What do you tell people like me?
Yeah, I say start small. And really, the trick is to proceed through the basics. In kindergarten, you learned, you know, plants need sunlight, soil, and water. And it's still true. So when you're picking a spot, you have to have at least 4 or 5 hours of good sunlight each day. You want easy access to water. And if you start with great soil, then your stuff just prospers. It grows really well.
Yeah. Why is there a difference between a front yard and a backyard garden? What does it matter?
Mm-hmm. So there's two things that come to mind. Often the best sunlight is actually in people's front yards. Okay. Backyards tend to be more shaded, more trees. And the front yard is, they're just built to be open and be accessible to the front porch and things like that. Secondly, the front yard garden is such a social connector. I've actually had gardens in my front yard my whole life because that's where the sunshine was, but it also was this tremendous icebreaker for my neighbors who are walking by because in the States, we're taught to kind of keep our head down and not engage too much. But if there's collard greens or tomatoes grown in the front yard, then the stories start coming out and people say, wait, is that a, and they ask the
right
question. And they say, oh, yeah, my grandfather used to, you know, or my grandmother had this recipe. And all of these stories and exchange starts happening. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Michael, why is this law a victory for the work that you do with Feeding Northeast Florida?
Yeah, absolutely. So these front yard gardens or gardens in general are a great intervention and tool to fight food insecurity. So I'm going to bore people for a moment and define terms. So food insecurity is really about having the access and the ability to afford food. So what you actually see is in a lot of the food deserts in our area, the people in the population can't afford a lot of the food. They pay more for the food that they have to get at gas stations or bodegas. And there is no availability of fresh produce. So the ability to actually build gardens and grow food that you could otherwise not get or afford is a great tool. And it's actually been very well shown that those home gardens are great interventions to improve nutrition, improve the access of those who are food insecure. And there's so many downstream effects of this. So as we get more gardeners in the community, we're going to have more ability to use that surplus or abundance to actually donate to those who need it. Mm. So one of the things that we used to do that was very effective, but the blight changed it, was we used to do an annual citrus drive, which got about 30,000 pounds of fresh produce, you know, citrus fruit, into the hands of the food insecure.
So that was people growing citrus locally?
It was just in their yards. And then we'd get dozens and dozens of volunteers, trucks, cars, and everyone would load up their vehicles with citrus, which is just slowed down because of the blight. I think with more gardens, and I've talked to some people over near the beaches who have built a bunch of community gardens, they want to donate that food. And I think that's going to be exciting because we know that the more fresh produce people eat, the healthier they are, the less they're going to have things like diabetes, high blood pressure, all the other negative health outcomes that come with not eating healthy food.
Right. Blight, is that a disease that's affecting the citrus?
Yeah, so it's just been messing with the amount that we've got for the harvests. We used to work with we still work with them, but Society of St. Andrews, they do a lot of gleaning, but it's just in this county right now, it's just not so productive, I guess.
Hmm. Are you starting a vegetable garden? Are you hoping to start a front yard vegetable garden? What questions do you have about starting one? Call us now, 549-2937. Have you had that experience that Nathan was talking about, walking down the front yard on your street and talking to people about their gardens? Nathan, how easy is it for people to start a garden in Northeast Florida? I've heard people say, and tell me if this is wrong, that, oh, I'm from a state like Iowa where you just throw seeds and anything grows. It's not so in Northeast Florida, though.
There's some truth to that. Our soil, you know, we're farm and beach. So that makes it tough. In Iowa, they've got this perfect blend of glacial till and the prairie fires from 1,000 years ago and all this. But you certainly can grow in Northeast Florida. And the great thing about growing here is actually that we can grow 12 months a year. So those gardeners in Iowa, they get a really productive 4 months, maybe 5 months if they're lucky, but then their season starts wrapping up. For us, our most productive gardening season is actually the fall. So starting in September, you can grow right through the winter and have bounty all year long.
When should you start planting?
My favorite time to start a garden actually is in September. September, October, grow through the fall, and then you can start the spring season in early March.
Okay. What are the best things to plant in our area?
In the fall, you grow lots of green vegetables, so collards and kale and chard and cabbage. Also those salad-like things, you know, lettuces and arugula. And then come spring, that's when you plant tomatoes and peppers and squash and cucumbers and things like that.
So everything that you could want for a salad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. What are some of the things that you might want to grow in the front yard versus the backyard? Are there things that might need some more shade?
Sure. So part of this is an aesthetic thing. So if you're growing in the front yard, you do want to keep it nicer. And a great way to do that is to grow in raised beds because they clearly delineate the yard from the garden. If you're growing fruits and roots in the sun, you need to grow fruits and roots in the sunshine. So tomatoes are a fruit, cucumbers, and roots like carrots or potatoes, they need lots of sun because they have sugars and carbohydrates in them. You can get away with growing the green leafies in a little bit less sunshine, or if you have a really shady spot, you can grow ginger and turmeric.
Okay.
They love the shade.
So now with this new law, people might have some more root vegetables and some more fruit in their yard.
Absolutely.
We have some callers on the line. Join us 549-2937 with your questions about urban farming, about this new law. Good morning. We have Ed on the line from Orange Park. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning. A real quick question. I know the law was just passed, which is great, but what about homeowners associations? Can they still keep somebody from growing vegetables and so on the front of the yard?
That's a great question, Ed. Nathan?
Yeah, so as I understand it, yes, since you voluntarily sign your homeowner agreement, then yes, but that's the next challenge, and I say that let's work on it. If you want to play strategy, I'd love to play that game because I can't count the number of folks who want gardens in HOAs that haven't been able to have them. And also, I've worked in CDDs, and the ironic thing is I was working with a team of neighbors to start a community garden, And they were saying, oh, edibles are ugly. They'll be unsightly. And we met at the community center, and underneath their sign were a bunch of edible kales and mustards and edible flowers. And I laughed, and, you know, we pointed that out, ended up being able to start that community garden. But it's a silly thing.
So maybe think about a community garden until it is allowed in your,
sure,
your community. Mm-hmm. Just a little background on this new law. It was a fight by a couple in Miami Shores, Florida, Hermine Ricketts and her husband, Tom. They had to uproot a garden that they had been tending for 17 years in their yard because of a local ordinance. And that was where this fight originated, that eventually got these local ordinances overturned in the legislature this year. On the line now, we have Paul downtown. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for calling.
So many years ago, when I had my goddaughter up in Jacksonville, Florida, from South Florida, her mother told me that she will not eat anything but burgers and fries. She doesn't like vegetables. And I had a raised garden at that point. And so her and I went to the store and we bought some seeds and we planted the seeds. She was with us 2 weeks. And I sort of played a little bit of a game with it where we planted carrots, and then I went to the store and I bought carrots, and within 3 days of watering and so on, we had these carrots growing and radishes and other things. And when she went home, her mother could not believe that she loved vegetables. And so encouraging your kids to get involved with it too may change their outlook on how good vegetables are really are good to taste and so on, which might help some of our diabetes problems, et cetera.
All right, Paul, thanks for the call. Nathan, is that what you've seen with people you've worked with?
Absolutely, Paul. There is a gentleman in California, and he says, if kids grow kale, kids eat kale.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Paul. Michael, I wanted to ask you about your efforts in helping people who are struggling with food insecurity, and how does that happen on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, on a day-to-day basis, we work with 160 agencies, and we provide them food to distribute to those in need. I think what's really interesting and tied to this is one of the things we do is we help individuals get SNAP benefits. And for those who don't know it, if you have SNAP benefits, you actually could buy seeds and plants that produce food to use to make a garden.
Hmm.
So you could actually make a sustainable kind of garden out of your SNAP benefits. We actually also, through the learning of this, because I think this is important to actually not only educate the community on the changes of laws and how to actually build gardens, but what we find is we get about 2 million pounds of food from farms. So I'm getting very familiar with the farm seasons. We have a very long cabbage season. We have carrots, potatoes, lots of melons. But there are is a need to better understand and educate people on how to use produce. And I think that's exciting. By growing it, you will learn how to actually prepare your spaghetti squash or your acorn squash, because there is a lot of, at distributions I've been at, when we actually hand those products out, they've not seen them. I don't know what to do with this. Thank you for giving it to me. And so we've been preparing recipes and recipe books to help educate them on that. I think that's going to be the exciting part of when all of these community groups come together, because there's no single leader on this. It's going to be community farms. It's going to be stable pantries. It's going to be local churches. It's going to be all the nonprofit sector getting together to help individuals with their nutritional needs, fighting food insecurity. It's going to take all of us on that. So it's going to be fun to kind of see who picks up the reins in which areas.
As food insecurity is happening, there's another issue, that's food waste. And how do you connect that immense food waste that happens with people who need that food? How do you see that happening in our community?
So I think that's why I think this is a wonderful tool to fight food insecurity. But there are some bigger issues right now when it comes to waste. So if you look at the U.S., there's 27 million tons of food wasted in the homes. That's actually the biggest sector. So people, you know, maybe you bought 3 cucumbers and you only used 1. Maybe there's some canned goods you don't know why you bought and you throw them away. I really implore people not to do that. If it looks like it has any shelf life, especially dry goods, because they will survive about a year after, still be very healthy and nutritious, and those could be given to those in need. I think there's also the next sector is anything consumer-facing, which I think is where we address a lot, and there's a lot of good work being done in the restaurants and the retail side. So lots of great partnerships in retail to rescue that food, make sure it's used again, and lots of good work being done in the restaurants. And I'm seeing, it's interesting, Feeding America is building apps that do this. Mm. There's already some local website apps, but they're working on connecting restaurants to and retailers to basically nonprofits to pick up that food. Okay. And there's a whole wonderful connection. It's, you know, it's the whole connecting app world we live in, and it's actually working very well. So we're actually picking up from retailers or stores that we've never done before. Huh. And that was just going to go right to the landfill.
Wow. So using that new technology, you're able to see what's available exactly where and go pick that up?
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. Okay. If people are feeling food insecure, if they're hungry, where can they find help, Michael?
They could call our headquarters, which is our distribution center, or they could easily visit feeding NEFL/food. So it's feedingnefl.org/food. It actually has a list of all of our pantries. We're working on actually showing our distributions as well. But anyone who has any issues with food insecurity, they could send a message on Facebook. They could email us. They could go to our website. They could call our warehouse, and we will help them get in contact with people who give out food.
Nathan, what are your efforts? What do they look like on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I help people grow their groceries. So I'm helping people pick a good garden spot. I am building and installing gardens, helping people plant, and then holding folks' hands going forward each season so they don't, you know, I don't get them started and then send them on their way. But if they need a helping hand, to clean up at the end of the season to get replanted. I'm a garden coach, if you will.
Where can people find your garden coaching services?
Yeah, maninoveralls.com.
Okay, and he is wearing the overalls right now. It is true. He is a man in overalls. Michael, are you looking for volunteers to get involved? Or if anybody would like to help out, what can they do?
Yeah. So anyone who wants to help, we need all sorts of help. We need advocates. We need people to understand what the face of hunger looks like. There's a lot of misconceptions of what it is. More than often, anyone who's actually using a pantry is using it once for an emergency need, about 70%. A lot of the people we help are actually seniors who are just trying to kind of age in place and not just degrade their life, which happens because benefits are being cut. The social safety net is just kind of falling apart for various reasons. And so the face of hunger needs to, people need to actually understand what that really is. A lot of it's just families trying to get by. So just understanding what food insecurity is a big first step. We always need volunteers. We have volunteers in our warehouse 5 days a week at least, sorting, inspecting food. We actually do food distributions. We go to Arlington, which is the Regency Mall. We go to the Ken Knight neighborhood, a number of other neighborhoods where we need volunteers to help distribute the food to those in need. So if you actually go to our website again, feedingnefl.org, and you could actually register to volunteer.
Great. And as you mentioned, this is an issue that affects people in their lifespan from young children all the way up to the end of their lives. And it's a lot of people in this 8-county area that Feeding Northeast Florida serves.
Yeah. So we have over 270,000 food insecure individuals in this area. So it's 1 in 6 approximately.
Wow.
However, 1 in 4 are children. So we have a significant number of children that are food insecure, and we address that a number of ways, partnering with local schools. We have a snack pack program to fight the weekend meal gap. So if you think about a lot of the food insecure students, they are relying on free breakfast, free lunch, and then the weekend comes. And the weekend comes, there's no guaranteed meals. And that actually gets completely exacerbated during the summertime as well, which is where we are, where a lot of kids just don't have access to food. So we're partnering with the YMCA, Florida Blue, doing a lot of food distributions to help kids right now.
If you have items that you would like to donate, whether it's food or maybe medicine for people How can you donate those?
So you could actually bring them to our warehouse. I really recommend, I think it's one of the things that I've seen people do that gets exciting, is to get your friends and neighbors, like either collect food, go through your cabinets, and the amount of meals that that can provide and just bringing it to a warehouse so we can distribute it to those in need is incredible. It's a nice activity. We have Paige is actually doing it again, but we've had Paige is a wonderful girl who actually does a peanut butter drive every year for us. And she's inspired other to do it too. So we've had three this year. So she's about to do a peanut butter drive for us and she usually brings a couple hundred pounds of peanut butter that we give to, yeah, it's amazing. It's to the kids and youth. And I usually try to ask whenever someone brings it in, like, who do you want this to go to? You know, do you want it to go to seniors? Do you want it to go to kids? And more often than not, the kids are always adorable. They just say, whoever, just take my picture.
Anyone who's hungry.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone who's hungry.
If you have any questions about front yard gardening or food insecurity in Northeast Florida, call us now, 549-2937. We're talking with Nathan Ballantyne, the man in overalls, an urban gardening coach. And we're talking with Michael Neff of Feeding Northeast Florida about food insecurity and how this new urban gardening law affects that here in Northeast Florida. So, Nathan, if you want to start a garden and you've never gardened before, is it going to be expensive?
Is it going to be expensive? It all depends on how you do it. You know, you can have the Titanic of gardens, or you can have the Geoprism or whatever.
The rowboat of gardens.
Exactly. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
So if you wanted to have the raised beds in your front yard, you could build them yourself.
Sure. Yeah, you can DIY. Absolutely. And I have tons of resources on my website. If you go to Man in Overalls and click on resources, I have a DIY raised beds resource and how to plant, how to, you know, all the basics. The simplest thing to do is start with a 4x4 or a 4x8 raised bed. And you can frame it with 2x10 lumber, and fill it with some kind of premium soil mix, something like my magic mix, but it doesn't have to be mine. I've got a knockoff recipe in my DIY raised bed, download resource. And then the critical piece is to plant in season. Where things get really expensive is when people plant things that are out of season. And so they either go straight to seed, or the pests tear them up. So it's all about growing simply and growing in season. That leads to good production and not a lot of waste.
Can you really replace the produce that you're used to buying elsewhere? How much are you going to actually get out of a garden in your yard?
Yeah, that's a good question. As a man in overalls, I don't aspire to replace everything I buy in the grocery store. What I do is I focus on those items that are most expensive and most valuable as they're freshest. So things like salad mix or tomatoes, right? You can buy tomatoes in the store. They don't taste as good, right? There's something about homegrown tomatoes. And also just the dollar value is significant. But if you're trying to grow, like, say, potatoes are relatively cheap in the store. So from my perspective, it makes more sense to focus on those things that are high dollar value and premium when they're fresh, and still go to the grocery store for those things that are more like commodities.
Are you somebody who does urban farming in your yard? I've seen recently the mayor, Lenny Curry, is talking about his urban garden. He has chickens, apparently, in his yard. I've seen that recently.
Nice.
Nathan, Why did you start urban gardening?
I started gardening because I homeschooled a couple of years growing up. And when I was in second grade, my mother helped me start a garden, actually with my sister, and she quickly bailed on it, but I fell in love. I love watching things grow, and there's magic in being able to take this tiny little piece of food and put it in the ground and grow more of the same, you know, grow tomatoes from tomato seeds. There's magic in that, and there's such a sense of accomplishment when you get to, you know, pick a warm tomato from a sun-warm tomato and bite down.
So it's been a lifelong love for you.
It has, yeah. I took 4 years off in college because I couldn't take care of my garden when I was away. But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. Michael, why, when you heard about this law being passed that overrides local ordinances, what was your first thought about that?
I actually had a conversation this Saturday about some ideas around helping kind of food deserts. And you mentioned Lenny Curry, and I don't know what he has in his yard, but I do know that you're allowed, I think, 5 hens in your yard. I'm not sure if that's the law. I think it's like 5 hens.
Okay.
And there was an idea around having supporting that. So not only can some of these communities grow hens and eggs, but combining that with kind of a garden in your front yard and other access to other food sources, whether it be SNAP benefits or the pantries that exist, I think they're just exciting ways to slowly build up areas or individuals that actually need that help to get food secure. And I think the nutrition aspect is so important. I mean, we have a lot of food come through our warehouse, and a lot of it's really healthy dry goods, but it's that produce that is so important, and it has such a short lifespan. So we have a giant cooler to actually make sure the produce stays fresh for as long as possible, but really fresh vegetables. I can just see the community getting behind this. I know as an example, there are over 160 agencies that do some sort of feeding. I can imagine them actually now having gardens. Like, there are so many who have volunteers as well who want to get into that process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's just going to be this huge opportunity to continue to find different channels of food for the area.
Mm-hmm. And it's so cool that with technology now, people are finding where that food is that is just waiting to be picked up and waiting to go to somebody who's hungry.
Yeah, I think that's going to be, I think if we could integrate these gardens with that kind of aspect, because I know volunteers so many willing people in the First Coast to actually help it fight, you know, food insecurity. Is just sometimes it's just finding the how. So whether it be if we could get a list of all the community gardens that need to be harvested and the volunteers could come pick them and bring them to one site so they could be distributed. There's just a ton of opportunities, I think, for this.
Are there existing community gardens or private gardens that already contribute in this way?
So we do have a couple agencies. I believe Clara White has a farm. Daily Man has been working on their own community garden. But these are just a small number of the agencies who are actually exploring this. So I think this should probably open the door for more of them to continue to grow their own produce. And it goes back to also that education. So helping kind of the clients or food insecure individuals not only understand where the food comes from and be connected to that, and also continuing to help them with their how to prepare the food, their nutrition education, that's going to continue to help not only food insecurity, but health outcomes. Because at the end of the day, when you're food insecure, you're actually stuck with a limited budget, and that's going to make you have to have some hard decisions. And usually it's the decision between food or your medicine,
right.
Decision between your food or your electricity bill, which I think, if I remember correctly now, it's around 5,000 power bills every month get shut down, just turned off. And many people actually have moved into like a pay-as-you-go plan for electricity, and they know every month they're going to be shut down for 2 to 3 days because they can't afford it. So there's just a lot going on where when you're food insecure, you're having to make those hard calls. So how do we help address that?
And your website, again,
is feedingnefl.org.
Feedingnefl.org. Thank you so much to Michael Neff from Feeding Northeast Florida. And also Nathan Ballantyne, the man in overalls. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Later in the hour, the First Coast Connect Book Club is here. And up next, fighting allergies this summer. This is First Coast Connect. We'll be right back. Just believe another day. Just breathe another day. Just believe. Just breathe. welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross this morning. Summer is here, and in Florida, that means not just wilting heat, but also allergies. Yep, if you or your kids are struggling with allergies right now, you know what I'm talking about. But we have some advice. Thankfully, Dr. Paul Walker is here. He's a board-certified otolaryngologist. I just said that on the radio.
You did well. I just say ENT. It makes it a lot easier.
And that's ear, nose, and throat.
There you go.
Ear, nose, and throat with Baptist ENT specialists. He's here in the studio. Hi, Dr. Walker.
Good to see you, Jessica. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks so much for being here. So allergies, are they that bad this summer?
You know, obviously it depends on the person, you know, grass season is here. One of the great things about Florida, it's a beautiful place to live, but our seasons go on and on and on.
Right.
I used to live in Georgia prior to moving to Florida, and we knew spring was here when all our colors of the cars were all yellow.
Right.
And we just say, okay, now it's tree season. Well, here that tree season goes on from January to April, and just month after month of it. And so same thing with the grasses, of course.
Okay, so grass is the
grasses
big offender.
Is the summertime, that's right. So typically when you think about seasonal allergies, we think about trees would be more of a spring, a winter spring kind of thing. Summertime would be more the grasses, and then we think about the weeds more in the fall time.
Okay. And the summer here, of course, lasts until December. So
on and on and on and on. And
yes.
Then to make things more interesting, we have these year-round allergies with dust and mold. Mm-hmm. And not that we have any issues with those here.
No, of course not. If you have any questions about allergies, call us now, 549-2937. We'll be happy to answer them. So, Dr. Walker, let's start with the difference between a couple of things that might feel similar to people, which
sure.
are allergies or sinusitis.
Okay, great question. So, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to differentiate what is an allergy and what is more of a what we call chronic sinusitis. From an allergy standpoint, sometimes it's obvious if there's a quick onset, like say I go visit my brother. I love you, Mark. You know, they've got cats. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I walk into that house, I start sneezing. Okay. So there's kind of a time issue related to that. And so that sneezing, runny nose, itchy eyes, that's that early phase of allergy. But there's also what's called a late phase of allergy, which is the wonderful or frustrating congestion that can come your way. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to tell with that early phase because of the timing factor. If the symptoms kind of linger on and on and on, that can lead to more of an inflammatory condition that tends to be long-term, and that can be what we consider chronic sinusitis.
So can one lead to the other?
Great question. Absolutely. Unfortunately, yes. We see a lot of times, in fact, a lot of patients that I see, they just kind of live with it, and then over time, this almost instead of a beaver making a something out of mud and sticks, little by little, this inflammation starts to block the sinuses, so the sinuses can't drain and they can't ventilate the way they're supposed to. And once the sinuses start to get blocked off, pressure builds, more infections occur, we start to see more fatigue. In fact, when patients come to see me, it's rarely about sneezing, runny nose, itchy eyes. A lot of times it's, I'm sick of being sick. I got this pressure between my eyes or my cheeks or my forehead.
Mm-hmm.
But when they look back, they think, you know, 3 years ago, I didn't feel like this. And now I feel kind of lousy pretty consistently.
So it was building up.
It was building up,
time.
Unfortunately.
Wow. And could it all start with a visit to your brother's house where there are cats?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, sorry about that. Yeah. It's a variable process. There's a lot of things that go into chronic sinusitis. When I evaluate a patient, there are structural issues. Some people are more narrow. Their margin is less. They may have what's called a deviated septum. Congratulations. if the divider nose is bent. There may be less airflow, so that can be an issue for some of our patients.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be some anatomical or structural issues, but that sensitivity component is huge. And yes, exposure matters. And so, yes, daily exposure to something that you are sensitive to can be problematic for some people.
Okay. So if you are somebody, let's just use an example like my husband, who is allergic to cats, and we have cats, so he's popping those Claritins a lot, right? So
this is all theoretical, right?
Yeah, completely hypothetical example. Yeah.
Right.
Is that an effective way of managing things?
So great question. So we break down allergy treatment into three parts: environmental modification, which, by the way, does not mean get rid of the cat. There's a lot of studies that say you'll get rid of your doctor before you get rid of your pets. But, you know, we try to figure out practical ways to decrease the exposure. So that might mean having a safe haven in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. So maybe no pets. One of my favorite pictures, I had a patient who had a picture of she was allergic to dogs, and she slept with like three or four dogs all around her head.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, let's start with step one. Maybe at the foot of the bed, maybe not right around your head.
Right.
But anyway, so exposure matters. And so having a safe haven, maybe having some kind of an air purification system within the bedroom, mm-hmm. just to have that a place to get some fresh air for a few hours, could be beneficial as a starting place.
Okay.
But it really depends on what the sensitivity is. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why a lot of times we'll test people is because we're trying to figure out a game plan that it really needs to be individualized.
Mm-hmm.
So environmental modification is number one. Number two is certain medications. And a lot of medicines now have gone over the counter. So that's a viable option. And then the third option for when the first two don't work is we talk about desensitization or retraining the immune system so that we're not overreacting.
Mm. And how does that work?
So great question. So when you get into desensitization is a weird word, but think of allergy as an exaggerated response to something. So if I touch you on the knee and you hit me with a baseball bat, that's an exaggerated response, okay?
Sure.
So once again, everything's hypothetical that we talk about here. But anyway, so there's this over-response of the immune system. And with medicines, you're blocking that response. You're trying to dampen that response. When we look at either something called allergy shots, which a lot of people are familiar with, or something called allergy drops, which are a big part of my practice for a lot of my patients, both those options retrain the immune system by incrementally giving the body exposure to something you're allergic to.
Okay.
And over time, your body says, oh, that's grass. Who cares? At first, it's freaking out, thinking, oh, my goodness, I hate grass. It drives me crazy, blah, 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 blah. But instead, once you've retrained that immune system over time, the term is tolerance. You just tolerate it, and you don't have that exaggerated response.
Okay. So if you are somebody who might be on the road toward a long-term kind of sinusitis situation,
right,
at what point does intervention make sense?
That's a really good question. You know, there's more and more studies that are showing that early intervention, I think we hear that across the board in medicine, makes sense. I think for me, it really depends. The two words I use are consistency and severity. When you start to feel like your symptoms are bothering you on a consistent basis, or they're really starting to affect your quality of life, that's when I think it may be time to at least get an initial evaluation, at least look at some options.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, you start out simple and at least know what your options are. But, you know, I think a lot of us are the go-getter kinds that just say, okay, I'm just going to live with it. I got a little congestion. I just keep going.
Yeah.
And I think if it's for a season or for a few weeks, that's one thing. When it starts to linger on and your energy level's not what it should be,
mm-hmm.
And people are saying, okay, what's going on with you? You may want to take a little inventory of what's going on.
That quality of life.
Absolutely. A lot to be said for quality of life.
Can you run me through these different options? So you mentioned shots and you mentioned drops. What are those?
Okay, so shots, once again, gold standard, have been around for decades and decades. I had them when I was a teenager. Once again, that's something where you go into the office typically once a week to start, mm-hmm. and start that retraining process. Allergy drops are something that really honestly did not become a viable option It started primarily in Europe in the late 80s, early 90s. Really didn't start coming over to the U.S. probably to the early 2000s. I started using allergy drops as an option for patients I think it was 2006 is when I first started. And it's been a wonderful option because of the convenience factor. The studies are very clear that it's extremely safe. We put them under your tongue, or you put them under your tongue. Actually, we give you the bottle. But once we test patients and find out what they're allergic to, we make a specific mixture for that particular patient.
Okay.
And that retraining begins with the drops under the tongue every day at home.
So besides these issues that we've already spoken about, what are some of the other things that people come to you for?
Great question. So another common one that I see is ear pressure, which, you know, at first glance, a lot of it's ear pressure. Where does that come from? You know, I think a lot of us had the experience of being on an airplane and the plane starting to descend. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, man, I wish my ears would pop. Please, right. Please, please. And then all of a sudden there's that gratification when I'm talking to my wife and all of a sudden, hey, I can hear you again. This is really great. You're not muffling anymore. And so we have patients that we see quite frequently that have that problem all the time. And that's an extremely frustrating problem.
I can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've learned over the years that the answer is not just a tube in the ear. You know, a lot of people have heard about tubes in kids' ears.
Yep.
And we still have times where I put tubes in adults' ears. But now we've got more and more evidence that shows that the combination of there's a sensitivity component and there's a structural component to that eustachian tube dysfunction. And so it's really important to identify with patients the sinus allergy component, as well as looking at the root causes for the valve issue.
Okay. If you are struggling with allergies right now, what is your number one piece of advice for people, Dr. Walker?
Wow, that's a loaded question. All right, so, it depends on what their symptoms are. You know, if their problems are typically, sneezing, runny nose, itchy eyes, then I would say, try to, obviously number one is trying to figure out what's bothering you and try to minimize your exposure to that. That's probably the first place I would start, is start with trying to figure out what you're around that's probably bothersome to you and minimize your exposure.
Thank you. That's Dr. Paul Walker. He is a board-certified otolaryngologist with Baptist ENT Specialist.
Song lyrics are among the most popular of online searches, but the business model behind them is tricky.
When you license lyrics from the music publishers, they don't actually provide you with official lyrics or anything.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How to make money off what you thought you heard, not being what you heard. We'll tell you more about that and the numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, which party is in power in the next decade in Congress and state houses could be determined by last month's Supreme Court decisions on gerrymandering and the census citizenship question, and by what the Trump administration does next about the census. We'll talk about why with Ari Berman, who covers voting rights for Mother Jones. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Busing has been an educational experiment for decades, an effort to bring more equity to public schools. Now it's at the heart of a passionate political debate.
There was a little girl in California, and she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
A primer on busing, what it was, how it works today, and whether it has worked. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Have you checked out WJCT's storytelling podcast, What It's Like?
We sing praises to the Khmer Rouge leader. They were always enforcing rules.
Some people are still figuring things out.
When you have PTSD, I don't know why certain battles come up and certain battles don't. Mm-hmm. I guess it's maybe the battles that really impacted you.
Others have come out on the other side.
When he started saying he was loving me more, I couldn't believe it.
Subscribe to What It's Like wherever you get your podcasts.
This book club segment is underwritten by San Marco Books and More.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, we have three summer reads for you to help you appreciate the great outdoors in Florida. Stacy Goldring is here with this month's First Coast Connect book club selections, which will make you want to get out and explore the Sunshine State's flora and fauna. I just know it. Hello, Stacy.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm so fantastic. Thanks to you and this plant that you have brought to the studio. It smells delicious.
Well, I brought in some of my own. I have two types of mint that I'm growing right now. So I have a chocolate mint, which is the smaller leaf, which everyone can visualize, I suppose. And then I also have the basic peppermint. Peppermint is actually an invasive, so if you do grow it, because it is so prolific, you want to grow it in a contained space just to be, naturally responsible. But I want to talk to our listeners today about books about Florida fauna and flora, because some people look outside and they're like, what the heck is it? And the best advice that I can give is make sure if you do select these books that you remember to enjoy just looking at whatever it is, as opposed to finding out the genus, the species, where the habitat, winters, et cetera. So the first book that I brought that no one can see, but you can visualize, is a very old Audubon guidebook. Mm. And it is the Field Guide to Florida. And this is, I would call this my Bible. And what you need to know about field guides is they need to be portable. So this is kind of thin. It can fit in a pocket, right. Throw in a backpack. And what's wonderful about field guides is there's a lot of information on every page. And I have written in all my books. So my books are also kind of like historical documents of what's been going on in my yard or on hikes, et cetera. So this would be the very first book that I could recommend. And it's put out by Audubon, the National Audubon Society Field Guide to Florida.
So if you have your Audubon Society Field Guide to Florida in Jacksonville, Stacy, where is your favorite place to take a book like this?
Well, first of all, anywhere, because you can even find things in your parking lot that you can find beauty anywhere in Jacksonville. I even take this into my backyard when I'm looking around to see what's going on. If you are waiting in carpool somewhere, you can actually get out of your car, turn it off, and go look at that patch of grass, and you can find a butterfly that is about this big, who's probably out there, or some bees pollinating. So there is never a reason not to take advantage of appreciating nature. It is always there, even though that was probably a grammatically incorrect sentence. All right, the second one I'm going to present to you is called Florida Birds, a Field Guide and Reference. And this is put out by Pineapple Press, which is a Florida press. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this book, and Jessica can see it, is that this book contains drawings. They're colored drawings.
Beautiful.
Of birds, and it gives great information. But let's say you don't want to read all this text that goes along with it. No matter, because there's also just a picture section. So if you see that thing that's brown, just go to where the brown is, and you'll find some birds that look brown. You go, oh yeah, it's an eagle. Okay, it's a whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So there are many ways to approach a guide. You don't have to read guides from beginning to end.
Right.
You just find out where it is. Here's like a checklist for people who are into that kind of thing. So there are many ways to approach a field guide.
Bird bingo,
yeah,
if you will.
Bird bingo. I love that. So this is the second edition, Florida's Birds, a Field Guide and Reference. And this is put out by Pineapple Press. And now I'm going to switch to photographs. Jessica, when you're in the outdoors and you're looking to identify things, there are pros and cons to looking at photographs versus a black and white pen and ink versus a color, colored pencil, whatever. So in this case, this is a great book. And someone told me that I don't want to read when I'm in the outdoors. I just want to make sure I can find what it is and see the title and a story. This book called Birds of Florida Field Guide by Stan Tekiela. It's all color-coded. It's just one page has the little birdie, and the other page just gives a quick reference, the habitat, the size, the eggs, blah, 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 and then some interesting notes by Stan. Mm-hmm. So it has a little bit of personality, but it is all coded strictly by color, and there are photographs. So sometimes you can tell in a photograph what something is, but when you get into things like little bitty finches and sparrows, sometimes drawings are better. There is also a Wildflowers of Florida field guide put out by the same author, same principle. So I have a whole stack of books like this that you can find on my Chapter End Notes Facebook page, or I'd be happy to come over to your backyard and let you know what you've got. I'm sorry I can't get to all of them, but I'm glad I could share those.
And you know a little bit about nature.
Just a little. Yes.
And you worked at Tree Hill Nature Center.
I did. All right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Stacy. Again, it's Chapter End Notes.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
If you want to her list of books for enjoying the outdoors this summer in Florida. Thanks very much, Stacy.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
That is our show today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is the director. Have any questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, Lights for Liberty, a vigil to end human detention camps. That's tomorrow. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect here on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. Have a wonderful day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.